This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 17th of October, these are our main stories. The United States says it's closely monitoring Israel to ensure that enough aid is allowed through to civilians in northern Gaza. Lebanon has accused Israel of deliberately targeting local officials in its latest wave of deadly airstrikes. Canada says India has made a horrific mistake by aggressively interfering in its sovereignty. Also in this podcast.
If we knew how we can actually manipulate the skin from not aging, we will have fewer wrinkles.
That may become a reality, as scientists say they've discovered how human skin is created from a stem cell. Aid agencies say it's nowhere near enough, but after 2 weeks, when the UN says there was no aid delivered to northern Gaza at all, Israel says 50 trucks carrying food and other essentials have entered the territory. There's been intense diplomatic pressure on Israel this week to allow more aid into Gaza from its key backer, America. It came in the form of a letter that was sent to Israel 4 days ago, threatening to withhold military aid. Addressing the Security Council on Wednesday, the US ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, warned Israel not to make the humanitarian situation in Gaza worse.
Food and supplies must be surged into Gaza immediately, and there must be humanitarian pauses across Gaza to allow for vaccinations and the delivery and distribution of humanitarian aid. A quote-unquote policy of starvation in northern Gaza would be horrific and unacceptable and would have implications under international law and U.S. law. The government of Israel has said that this is not their policy, that food and other essential supplies will not be cut off, and we will be watching to see that Israel's actions on the ground match this statement.
Britain's ambassador to the UN, Barbara Woodward, warned of harsher conditions ahead for Gazans.
We expect October to see the least aid enter Gaza since the beginning of the conflict, lower even than September. Families in Gaza are facing a second winter with even less resilience and fewer resources. This is unconscionable. Israel must comply fully with international humanitarian law and ensure sufficient aid reaches all parts of Gaza.
Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danon, said his country is committed to allowing aid into Gaza, saying there was no shortage of it, but that Hamas is to blame for delays.
Israel has flooded Gaza with as much aid as possible. This session has entirely missed the real issue at hand. The issue in Gaza is not a lack of aid. More than enough aid has entered to sustain every civilian in Gaza, with over 1 million tons delivered since the war began. And it's not due to Israel's efforts or failure to deliver humanitarian assistance. The real issue is Hamas. This terrorist organization has hijacked the aid.
I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Wira Davis, what evidence, if any, there was that Hamas is hijacking the aid, as claimed by Israel's ambassador to the UN, Mr. Danon.
I think, actually, some of the aid agencies would say that when there's a breakdown of law and order and aid is very scarce, then yes, criminality come in. Nobody's denying that, but that in itself is part of the problem. What the UN and the other aid agencies are saying is that if there was enough aid, then the criminality that we are seeing now in parts wouldn't happen. Because there is so little aid coming through, particularly October was the worst month for aid getting through in several months, perhaps during the entire conflict. Even today, in the last 24 hours, only 50 trucks of aid finally got through the Erez crossing on the northern border. But that is much, much less than the 500 trucks or so a day that are estimated to be needed, especially in northern Gaza, where we've got these 300,000 people who've had, according to the World Food Programme, have had no aid deliveries since the start of October. Now, that has changed in the last 3 days since this letter was sent from the Americans, basically urging action, but it's nowhere near enough.
Indeed, I'm the main humanitarian organisation for the UN that's working in Gaza. OCHA says that 500,000 people are suffering from catastrophic food insecurity. These 50 trucks of aid that have got through, I mean, to what extent will they make a dent in the humanitarian situation, do you think?
Well, hardly any at all. I mean, this aid that got through today originated in Jordan. I mean, the Israelis say there is some stacked up waiting to go in, some on the inside. But it's pretty clear what is stopping the aid getting from wherever it is, even if it's at the border fence. What's stopping it getting to Jabalia in northern Gaza is the intense nature of the Israeli military operation at the minute. Israel is doing what some people call this policy of trying to wipe the whole area clean, because that is where Israel believes that the remnants of Hamas are being based. The problem is there are 300,000, if not more, civilians there as well. They're not being given the opportunity to get out. That's pretty clear, according to almost every agency you speak to. And even when they do get out, they're being marshalled towards areas that are declared safe by Israel, but then those areas are getting hit as well, as we saw with the hospital compound 2 days ago when several people were killed. So it's a pretty desperate situation.
We're at Davis in Jerusalem. Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mikati has accused Israel of deliberately targeting local officials in airstrikes now known to have killed 16 people in the Lebanese city of Nabatea. The city's mayor was among those who died in the attacks, which struck Nabatea's municipal building. The council had been holding a crisis meeting to coordinate humanitarian help to the local population. Tom Bateman reports.
Lebanon's government has castigated Israel over the attack on a municipal building in the town of Nabatea, accusing it of deliberately targeting local officials. Israel says it was striking at what it called Hezbollah bases. The airstrike killed the mayor, who was affiliated with Hezbollah, but who locals say was a civilian. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller declined to say whether the U.S., which arms Israel, regarded him as a legitimate target, saying the U.S. didn't yet have enough information about the airstrike.
With state institutions in Lebanon now fragile and the economy weak, private individuals are helping one another. The BBC's Jonathan Head has been out and about in Beirut.
So I'm strolling along Beirut's famous corniche, the seaside promenade, popular with joggers, fishermen and street vendors. But these days there are also tents and groups of families sitting around who've been displaced by the Israeli bombing campaign. More than a million people, one-fifth of Lebanon's population, has been uprooted by the conflict, tens of thousands of them here in the capital in just the last few weeks. The needs are enormous and the government is unable to meet them. So ordinary people have stepped in to help each other. Well, we've come to a restaurant in Beirut's Hamra district. Like so many parts of the city, it's accommodating huge numbers of people who've been displaced by the conflict. And this restaurant, Mezian, is doing its bit to help by offering free meals to those who've had to leave their homes.
My name is Jad Hamdan. I'm the operations manager of Mezian.
So what are you cooking here?
It's rice and meat with the sauce, with the like pepper sauce, and we need to distribute it to the people.
Tell me why you started this.
As you know, that's always bad situations here in Lebanon. Now this war displaced people from south, from Beirut suburbs. We are trying to do something, and as we are at the restaurant, we are preparing food for these people to just help them with at least one meal per day. Because, you know, the prices now are really high, and maybe they're coming without their money, and some of them, they lost already their houses, their job. So we are trying to do something. So now we reach like 500 meals daily. You know, some apartments, four, five families, like 20 people, the same house. So we are trying our best to reach what we can do for them only.
And you're still running a normal restaurant business on top of this?
Exactly, exactly. I think the business is going down like 70% from before. But at the same time, we are trying to help the displaced people here in Beirut.
So we're zipping through Beirut's crazy traffic. I'm on the back of a bike with Jad, carrying food for the Salum family. They've had to take in a lot of relatives in just one small apartment.
Sit down. Hello. So we've arrived. Shukran, thank you. So, Ali, how many people are living in this apartment?
Around 15.
15?
Yeah.
Very crowded.
Yeah. We are like a family.
A big family?
Yeah.
You don't know how long this will last, do you?
No, we don't know, but we are hoping to end very soon.
So no privacy for you here?
No, everywhere no privacy. And there's no safety, and everywhere is, maybe it's going to be bombing. No one knows. You're going to go outside on the street and you don't know if you're going to come back or no.
You never feel safe?
No. Thanks God, we are still alive for now.
That report was by Jonathan Head in Lebanon. The White House says the US is to announce a new security assistance package for Ukraine. That's following a phone call between President Biden and Volodymyr Zelensky. A spokeswoman said much of Mr. Biden's visit to Europe starting on Thursday would focus on support for Ukraine in its war against Russia. But the US president will not be meeting Mr. Zelensky himself. The Ukrainian leader on Wednesday presented what he called a victory plan to win the war with Russia to his parliament. He said it must include an accelerated path to NATO membership and the end of restrictions on long-range strikes on Russia. The Kremlin dismissed the plan and warned it would push NATO towards direct conflict with Russia. James Waterhouse reports from Kyiv.
President Zelensky's conditions for peace are increasingly at odds with the situation he's in. In front of MPs, he acknowledged the growing fatigue in his country. His own tiredness was etched across his face. National morale has gradually been crumbling under the weight of the mounting number of deaths, a controversial mobilization law, and never-ending Russian assaults. Instead of hinting at a territorial concession, President Zelensky doubled down on his demand to force Russia to completely withdraw from his country.
We must speak honestly. If we don't step up now, Putin will have time to step up next year in such a way as to put an end to diplomacy forever. Russia must lose the war against Ukraine. And this is not freezing the conflict, and this is not a trade in the territory or sovereignty of Ukraine. We must implement the victory plan to force Russia to be at the peace summit and ready to end the war.
His plan included an invitation for Ukraine to join NATO, as well as for a further strengthening of his country's military. Mr. Zelensky said his proposals only required the support of his Western allies and not Russia. With Moscow continuing to occupy a fifth of his country and counting, it will beg to differ.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said that India has made a horrific mistake by aggressively interfering in Canada's sovereignty. Mr. Trudeau told an inquiry into foreign interference that while he did not want to pick a fight over the murder of the Sikh separatist and Canadian national, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, he would stand up for his country's interests. India denies any involvement. Rebecca Hartman reports.
Prime Minister Trudeau accused the Indian government of enabling and in some cases directing violence against Canadian citizens. Mr. Trudeau criticised the Indian government's response to the investigation into Hardeep Singh Nijjar's murder, who was shot and killed in Vancouver in June 2023. The row between the two countries escalated earlier this week when Canada expelled six Indian diplomats, saying they had ample, clear and concrete evidence identifying them as persons of interest in the investigation into the murder.
Rebecca Hartman. The authorities in Nigeria say that at least 147 people are now known to have died after a fuel tanker exploded after crashing in the northwestern state of Jigawa. The victims had been trying to recover leaking petrol, having overwhelmed officers trying to keep them away from the scene. Dozens more were injured in the blast. Nkechi Ogbonna reports from Lagos.
Police say most of the victims were adult men with no women or children among those who died. Fuel tanker explosions are not new in Nigeria, where people rush to broken down tankers conveying fuel with the slightest spark, resulting in tragedy. The country is facing harsh economic times with a soaring inflation and recurrent fuel scarcities and price hikes, forcing many to adopt desperate measures.
Nkechi Ogbonna in Nigeria. Still to come, they are not plants, not animals, but they are getting special treatment. Find out what they are later in the podcast. In Britain, a public inquiry into the death of a woman, Dawn Sturgis, who was poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok in 2018, has been hearing about the moment she and her boyfriend opened the bottle that contained it. The inquiry was told the same bottle was likely to have been used in the assassination attempt of the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia several months earlier, in which they were both poisoned. Our correspondent Duncan Kennedy reports from the inquiry in Salisbury in southern England.
The Nina Ritchie branded perfume bottle has become one of the key pieces of evidence of the public inquiry. Charlie Rowley had found the bottle and taken it home to give to Dawn Sturgis as a present. Today, chilling details were given of when the couple removed the packaging, not knowing it contained the deadly nerve agent Novichok. Andrew O'Connor, KC for the inquiry, read Mr. Rowley's statement to police, in which he said he used a knife to prise off the plastic wrapping, spilling the oily contents in the process.
He says, when I got it on my hands, I smelt it. Didn't smell of perfume. It was oily. That's not right. I was quite covered in it, so I washed it off. Dawn sprayed a bit on her wrist. After a minute, I went into the bathroom to see what she was doing, and I found her lying in the bath with her clothes on, just lying in the bath, convulsing and foaming at the mouth.
Later, Commander Dominic Murphy, the head of the Met's counter-terrorism operation, said he believed it was likely that the bottle of perfume Charlie Rowley found was the same one used in the attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal 4 months earlier, but that it would never be known for sure.
Duncan Kennedy. A former singer with the British pop band One Direction, Liam Payne, has died in Argentina. The 31-year-old had been staying at a hotel in Buenos Aires. Police say he fell from an upper floor. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
Emergency services say Liam Payne fell from the third floor of a hotel in the upmarket suburb of Palermo. They say he suffered very serious injuries that were incompatible with life. The Argentine newspaper La Nación reported that police had been called to the hotel earlier as the singer had been behaving erratically. He had posted on social media that it was a lovely day in Argentina. Liam Payne shot to fame when he was just a teenager, after auditioning on X Factor and joining One Direction, along with Harry Styles, Niall Horan, Zayn Malik and Louis Tomlinson. The group were hugely successful and became one of the best-selling boy bands of all time. They toured the world and had millions of fans before they announced an indefinite hiatus in 2016. Liam Payne went on to launch a solo career. And had a child with the Girls Aloud singer Cheryl. He also spoke publicly about struggling with his mental health and addiction to alcohol.
Charlotte Gallagher. We will not rest. Those were the words chanted in Spain by protesters around the country after the death 3 years ago of Samuel Luis. The 23-year-old nursing assistant was beaten to death outside a nightclub, prompting anger and serious questions about homophobia in the country. Now, five people have gone on trial charged with his killing. Our correspondent Guy Hedgeko in Madrid told me more about the attack in which Mr. Luis was killed.
This took place in July of 2021 in the northern city of A Coruña. This was just when bars and restaurants and other establishments were opening up after the pandemic. And Samuel Luis was out with a female friend in the evening, and he was outside a bar, and he was on his phone on a video call with another friend. And a man came out of a nearby bar and seemed to think that Samuel was filming him with his phone, which appears not to be the case. But the man who thought he was being filmed then started insulting Samuel Luis and then attacked him and was insulting him using homophobic slurs. And other people then joined in, other friends of this man, in attacking Samuel Luis. And they were kicking him and punching him. And he managed to get away briefly, but he was chased up the street by this group of people where they continued to attack him brutally. Eventually, he ended up in hospital, and the next day he was pronounced dead.
Five people are accused of his killing, in connection with his killing. What do we know about what happened in court and those five accused?
Well, the five are facing potentially, if they're found guilty of killing Samuel Luis, jail sentences of between 22 and 27 years. That's what the state prosecutor's calling for. Two of them are facing the allegation that this was a hate crime, that not only were they involved in killing him, but this was motivated by their own homophobia because of the kind of language that they were using when they attacked him. Their defence teams appear to be using the defence that some of them had been drinking, and also that it's very difficult to identify the exact extent to which each of them was involved in the attack on Samuel Luis. You know, to what extent was it pushing and shoving or something much more serious? So they're saying that it's impossible, with the evidence available, to identify each person, what their role was in this awful incident.
Now, Guy, in the immediate aftermath of the killing, there was a lot of activity, people condemning homophobia in general after that. How is this trial being viewed in Spain?
That's right. One of the plaintiffs in this case is a local LGBTQ group, which says it hopes that this case will make a big difference. And they seem to see this potentially as a landmark. I think they want the judge in this case and the jury to take the view that this was very much driven by homophobia. So I think people were generally shaken by this attack, by the sheer brutality of it. And that's why it drew this very strong reaction.
Guy Hedgko in Madrid. Now, you might think that mushrooms are just for cooking and eating, but along with other types of fungi, they have a much more important role in our lives and the environment around us. That's why Britain and Chile have teamed up to sponsor a pledge for fungal conservation, which they will propose at this year's UN Biodiversity Summit in Colombia next week. Sophie Smith has more details.
In the depths of the Amazon rainforest, tiny brown mushrooms grow out of the side of a tree. They don't look like much. These fungi are critical to the way the jungle and the rest of the world operates. Fungi help to rejuvenate soil, store over a third of global carbon emissions each year, and break down harmful plastics. In fact, scientists specialising in the organisms, or mycologists, say that without them, most plants are unable to live outside of water, and therefore life on Earth as we know it would not exist. The fungus kingdom, which includes mushrooms, mould, mildew, yeast and lichen, was only recently recognised as separate to animals and plants. But a new initiative by the UK and Chile is looking to change the way the world sees fungi. The two governments are co-sponsoring a pledge for fungal conservation, in which they ask countries to acknowledge fungi as a separate entity in legislation, policies and agreements to encourage concrete conservation measures around the so-called Third Kingdom. The plan will be submitted to the UN Conference on Biological Diversity, COP16, which starts next week in Cali, in southwestern Colombia, not far from the Amazon rainforest, which scientists say is teeming with fungal life.
Sophie Smith reporting there. Now, many people are worried about the effect that ageing will have on their skin. Researchers here in Britain have made a discovery now that could slow the process. The team has determined the process by which human skin is created from a stem cell. They're cells that have not yet become specialised for a specific function. The scientists identified which genes are switched on and off during a person's development and ageing, and were able to grow small amounts of skin tissue in a laboratory. This breakthrough could be used for skin transplants after burns or to help patients heal without scars after surgery. Here's our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
The basic building blocks of humans are cells. When embryos are first fertilised, they're all the same. But after 3 weeks, they begin to specialise and clump together to form the various bits of the body. The secret to learning how humans are built lie deep in the heart of these cells, specifically the Human Cell Atlas project aims to find out which genes are turned on at what times and in which locations. Researchers have now published details of how this happens in skin. Professor Muslifa Hanifa of the Wellcome Sanger Institute, just outside Cambridge, explained the benefits of the project.
If we knew how you can actually manipulate the skin from not aging. We will have fewer wrinkles. If we knew how to kind of like enhance the bone density, we will be having much better bones, enhance our heart, all of those things that can rejuvenate organs. So if you understand what happens during development at aging, you can then try to actually intervene and say, how do I make the heart younger? How do I make the skin younger?
So it sounds like the Human Cell Atlas was invented for someone like me.
I think it was invented for all of us.
That vision, though, is some way off, but there could be some more immediate applications, such as growing skin artificially for transplantation for burns victims and to have scar-free healing after surgical procedures.
Palab Ghosh. And that's all from us for now. But before I go, I just wanted to ask a favour. We're recording a special edition of the podcast ahead of this year's UN Climate Change Conference, which starts on November the 11th. I'll be hosting the programme with two of the BBC's top climate change experts. And we want you to send us your questions for them right now, preferably as a voice note. How's the world changing? How are we adapting? Are nations reneging on their emissions targets? Anything you like. Yorgos Spanos from Greece has already got in touch. He wants to know what happens if our oceans stop being able to absorb more carbon dioxide. Great question. Please send yours to us at the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition of the podcast was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.